Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Rich Cohen's new book is called The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones. I know, you're thinking, just what we need, another book about the Stones. But this one is different. It's also the story of a young journalist who finds himself on the road with the most famous rock band in the world. And it's the story of a changing Western culture seen through the lens of the music, the musicians, and us, the listeners. Rich Cohen is co-creator of HBO's series Vinyl and a New York Times bestselling author, and he's here with us on Soundcheck. Rich, good to see you.
Good to see you.
You must have had some kind of thoughts along those lines of, do we need another Rolling Stones book?
Yeah, but somebody once told me it's like a fisherman. When you go and there's a lot of cars parked, it means there's a lot of fishermen, but there's also a lot of fish. You know? And I sort of think when books keep getting written, it's because no one's really gotten it. You know, the big fish is still down there. And it's high risk, high reward, because if you get it, you know, if you really nail it, then kind of books stop for a while.
Yeah. When Keith Richards' autobiography, A Life, came out, what did that give you pause? Did that give you more, was that still more fisherman? You know, what was
well,
that?
I reviewed it for Rolling Stone. I read it very early. I was sort of shocked by it because I thought it was almost like Weekend at Bernie's told from the point of view of Bernie. I mean, I thought he'd been unconscious that whole time. So, you know, I thought it was a great book, but what it showed me was what there wasn't was the big picture. You know, step back and write about this in the whole history of rock and roll and the history of the baby boomers. I thought of it kind of as the baby boomer story told by Generation X. I grew up with this music. The first records I remember coming out were Emotional Rescue and Some Girls. I was a little kid, and that music suggested everything sort of dirty and dark that I wanted to try when I got older.
Yeah.
And I felt like all the great books about them had been written almost like in the middle of it, you know, like Cinema Verte, like the Maisels brothers. And nobody had stepped back and written it as if it all happened 50 years ago and what does it mean? And I feel like a lot of, because of the internet, a lot of what writing can do is now not just tell you what happened, but try to figure out what it meant. And that's what I tried to do.
Well, and the title of the book kind of hints at it, The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones, that the Stones are bigger than just a band.
Right.
They're not just a band. They're kind of an icon or an exemplar of what you were just talking about, a kind of a sea change.
Yeah.
There really was a gap in generations between the 50s and the 60s, and they were at that fault line.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, the sound of Chicago, where I'm from, which was Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, all that, kind of went off into the ether.
I have a little red rooster, too late to crow for day.
And it bounced off of England and came back to us in the form of the Rolling Stones.
Keep everything in the farm, y'all. Upset in every way.
And suddenly the Stones took this music that they heard on an armed forces radio from American soldiers.
Right.
And in copying it, they kind of turned it into something new.
The dogs begin to bark. Hounds begin to howl. Dogs begin to bark, hounds begin to howl. Watch out, strange camp people, little red roosters on the prowl.
I always thought, because I grew up on the north side of Chicago, that it's like the longest trip from the north side of Chicago to the south side was through London.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and the Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones was something that Keith said to me, which when he figured out what year I was born, he started to laugh. And he said, you should be answering questions for me. For you, the Stones have always been there. It's always been the Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones. It's like, oh my God, that's right.
Yep. And for the generation before you, you know, I mean, it's fun to hear you say, you know, they represented all the dirty, dangerous stuff I wanted to do when I get older. You know, for kids in the 60s, I think it was the exact same thing. And I know for me in the 70s, it was the exact same feeling. You know,
right.
So they somehow have been able to do that
Well, there's a really interesting thing, which is their original manager, Andrew Lou Goldham, told him at one point that to stay relevant, you have to reinvent yourself every 5 years. Because 5 years is how long it takes a kid to go from being a sophomore in high school to out in the world. And now there's a new sophomore in high school, and that kid wants his own music. He doesn't want his older brother's music. So you have to become a new band for that kid. And that's the story of the Stones, which is reinventing themselves every 5 years. For so many different generations, they were the new music on the radio, which is why they have this tremendous fan base now.
Well, and one of the interesting early moments in their story comes, and it happens fast. You write that in a moment, they go from playing in little clubs for guys who are interested in the blues to suddenly playing in big clubs for screaming teenage girls.
Right.
And it happens like that.
Right. And that's one of the most interesting things, which is they play for this sort of aficionados of blues music, people just like them. And in the audience are people like Eric Clapton, who are bringing records. And suddenly it's like teeny boppers. And I had this great exchange when I was a reporter traveling on the Rolling Stones plane with Keith Richards, where he's like, that's when you make the deal with the devil, right there. And there's always this, you leave that little audience and you go into the greater world. And he said, but for us, we sort of thought it was going to be that for a minute. You think it's going to be that forever. And if you can get through that, you can get back to the music again. You got to go through that phase to last. And it's almost like the Beatles at a certain point quit traveling on the road because they couldn't stand that, I don't think. And they said, you know, you can only go, we only can go so far on the road. And Keith Richards basically says there's no end of the road, that for him, the music isn't complete until it's played before a live audience. And that really goes back to their roots as the, probably the greatest bar band in the world.
And it's funny, you mentioned the Beatles. And, of course, the story of John Lennon and Paul McCartney writing I Want to Be Your Man for the Stones. That story has been told a lot. But in this, the context of what we're talking about now, this sudden change from, you know, blues aficionados to sex symbols.
Right.
You write that the Beatles understood that, looking at the Stones, before the Stones themselves did.
Right. Like my father always says, does a fish know it's in the water? You know? And like the Stones had no perspective on themselves, and they were very much like the Beatles. And Keith Richards later said, well, when we showed up, the Beatles were already wearing the white hats, so what was left for us? And early on, Andrew Lou Goldham understood that there was a niche. There was sort of this vacuum created by the Beatles, which is the Beatles were going to be all about love, and the Stones, that left sex. The Beatles were going to be good, and the Stones were going to be evil. And that became almost a marketing thing for the Stones that goes all the way up to Altamont and Sympathy for the Devil. You know, Play with Fire. They always have this Her Satanic Majesty's Request. And the joke of Altamont, which is the sort of the show that ends that, to me, is like for many years Mick Jagger had been dressing up and pretending he was the devil.
Mm-hmm.
And then he threw a big party, and the devil showed up.
Antipathy, you actually state this in the book at one point, not for rock, but for arena rock,
right,
which becomes a kind of facsimile rock.
Right.
So at some point, the Rolling Stones find themselves on the road playing ever bigger and bigger halls and eventually become an arena rock band.
Right. It's like almost that your success forces you out of your natural habitat, which is a bar where it's 3 a.m. and everyone's drunk and they sort of found the groove. And you know, to me, I approach this as a little brother locked out of his big brother's room and could hear honky-tonk women through the closed door. And I wanted so badly to be in that room and wasn't allowed to be. And then I went to college in New Orleans, and suddenly I was seeing music where I hadn't seen it, which was in little bars, bands like Dash Rip Rock and the Long Riders, you know, where you're—
Professor Longhair.
And the Neville Brothers and the Meters, you know, and it was the intensity of it. you know, made me see, okay, this is what the Rolling Stones must have been like in 1964 in London, and this is what people are talking about. And, you know, and it's weird because when I was reporting on this long time ago, the Rolling Stones did a little pop-up gig that they brought me to, which was at a club in Toronto playing a little bar with like 300 people. And you're like, oh, my God, this is the Rolling Stones. Because in an arena, everything is diffused. They're just not right. And when people would sometimes say, you know, I saw the Rolling Stones at Meadowlands. I didn't like them that much. They were okay. I'm like, well, you didn't really see the Rolling Stones. I mean, the Rolling Stones exist in a little bar. That's where they belong, where they're all jammed close together on a stage and they're a band.
Mm-hmm. Although I saw them, you know, at Madison Square Garden. It was one of the first concerts I ever went to, and it was pretty great.
Yeah.
But of course, they were at, you know, still riding the wave of those great albums of the early 70s.
But it's also like you take grain alcohol and how much water are you going to add to it? Yeah, I mean, if it's half water, you still get pretty drunk. But when they're in a bar, it's completely grain alcohol.
Well, now, you talk about going to school in New Orleans and seeing all these bands and stuff, and it's about that time, right, that someone gives you a ticket to see the Rolling Stones, and they're doing their big arena tour.
Right. I'd first seen them in Rosemont Horizon in Chicago when Tattoo U came out, which I think was like the last real album in a way. And then, you know, I kind of went off, and just like Andrew Lou Goldham said, I wanted my different bands. And I had a friend that worked at Hilton or something. He was a concierge, and he gave me a couple tickets to see the Stones. And I was basically so high in the Superdome, I was almost could touch the roof of the Superdome. You know, and it was like...
Okay, so you were physically high, not...
Yeah, yeah. Physically high.
Okay.
And whatever else. And I just felt like, you know, it just wasn't... It was just so far away. Yeah. It's like when you go to a football game and you're like, are we winning? Are we losing? Wait, did we just score?
So, you know, you're right about that first concert that, you know, they started with, maybe it was Jumpin' Jack Flash, maybe it was Brown Sugar, who knows, who cares, it all sounded alike. But then you find yourself eventually on the bus, on the plane,
right,
with the band. How do you get, you know, how did you get back into kind of appreciating the Stones for who and what they were in that context?
Right. Well, I never... ever stopped loving the Stones, and they were sort of the bedrock, and to me, they're the basis of a band. So a band should have five members. A band should have two guitars. A band should be based in the blues. A band should have some foot in Chicago. I always felt that because of the Stones. Somebody in the band should be addicted to something. Two guys should be fighting and hate each other. You know, those are all the basic things you should have with a rock and roll band, and I just kind of went away. But, you know, even when later on, like I remember like the song Tell Me, an early Stones song, I think the first Jagger Richards song, when it would catch me unawares, I'm like, oh, my God, this is the greatest music, and this is the greatest band. And what happened is I came to New York, and I got an interview at Rolling Stone with Jan Wenner. And a friend of mine said, listen, Jan's going to ask you what you most want to write about in the world. Don't tell him the truth, because whatever you tell him, you'll never get that assignment. So he said, what do you most want to write about in the world? And I said, Bob Dylan. And 6 months later, he sent me to Toronto to hang out with the Rolling Stones as they put together their show. And I was in this little gym in an elementary school at night. You wonder what goes on in your school at night while the Rolling Stones are rehearsing. And they were just, you know, standing around. Bill Wyman was out of the group then, but the other four guys, and with an engineer, and they would just talk through songs, and they would shout out a song, and an engineer would play it on a CD, and they would listen to their own music, which I thought was incredibly kind of weird and cool. Mm. Ron Wood would write down the chords, because a lot of times he'd been playing Mick Taylor or Brian Jones's work, and then they would try to play it, and if they played a couple times, if there was something there, they'd write it on a board, and slowly over basically 2 weeks, they put together this show.
Hmm.
So, and that experience got me completely back into the Rolling Stones.
Yeah. You write about interviewing Mick Jagger that, you know, it goes back to the fishing metaphor that we started with, that you're sitting there and you're looking at your tape deck thinking, I am a fisherman and I am catching all the best stuff right now. And then you go back and you listen to the tape later and it's like, my net is empty.
Right.
Which is a great way of putting it. I mean... is he that slippery and elusive even when you're with him long term over, you know, in really close quarters?
Yes, and I think kind of brilliantly so, which is he has this innate realization that basically mystery equals power. And that when you meet somebody new, you want to kind of peg him. Oh, this is like that guy, or he's from here, and then move on. So Jagger has made it so he cannot be pegged. So when you talk to him, you think he's saying this incredible stuff, like some pro athletes. And then when you go back and see the transcripts, you realize he didn't say anything. you know, and you can't peg him. So you go back to try to figure him out. He's like a math problem you could almost solve but could never quite solve. And Bob Dylan's great at that. I think Prince was great at that. And it's this idea of distance. So there's kind of a coolness instead of a warmth. But then he's balanced against Keith, who you'd interview Keith, and you, I'm not getting anything, man. I'm getting like a tire and like a catfish. I can't understand a thing he's saying. He's mumbling. And then you get that transcribed by a really good transcriber who's like translating a foreign language, and you're like, oh my God, it's brilliant. Everything he said is completely brilliant.
Now, when Keith Richards' book came out, he famously kind of had nothing to say to anybody apparently except you, right, as you point out in the notes at the end of the book.
If you listen to that, read that book, it's almost a big, long complaint about Mick Jagger.
Right.
And he says a lot of really mean things about Mick Jagger.
Right.
And I talked to Jagger about that, and he just said, okay, let's just say everything Keith said is absolutely true. But now imagine it's being said by a heroin addict. You know, and now imagine you have a huge tour plan that you've been spending 4 months working on and that everything depends on it, and he gets busted.
Yeah.
You know, and now it looks different. And you really realize one of the big mysteries of the Rolling Stones is, why did they last when no one else did? And I spoke to a lot of the guys of that generation who were friends with them, and they all said the same thing. It's Mick Jagger.
Yeah.
His drive and his ability to not comment on Keith Richards' book and not get hung up on that and to keep moving forward is what's caused that band to survive.
It was interesting. You say that Jagger thought that Keith hadn't actually written the book, that he'd kind of just...
Well, he said, at one point he said, he sort of implied, you know, and there's a history of that. You know, famously Charles Barkley, the basketball player, when his book came out, claimed he'd been misquoted in his own book. You know? So there's definitely a history of that, and I guess it's possible, but when you read that book, it seems so much like Keith Richards, and it's the most genius ghostwriter in the world, because it so clearly is Keith. But then I sort of thought, okay, this is what Jagger has to tell himself to keep performing with the Rolling Stones, because when I first read that book, I thought, well, that's it, man. That's the end of the Rolling Stones. They can't stand on a stage together anymore after the things that Keith Richards wrote, and I was wrong.
But how many times have we been wrong about that? At various points in the book, you use terms, you refer to Narnia. You refer to, like, Brian Jones wanting to live in a fairy tale. This idea of reality, unreality, surreality, you know, that there are distinctions there that most of us would recognize. It seemed to blur,
right,
in this story.
Well, for me, for sure, it was like going into Narnia, going into their world. You know, it's like you tumble through this wardrobe and you're in this other world you heard about but didn't really believe existed. You know, like my whole life, I thought there might be a party like this. And I got to the party and everyone was kind of old. That was what was kind of shocking to me. And then, you know, with these bands and the lives they looked like they were going to live, these British guys, which was most of them. You know, I always said Keith Richards might have been the cab driver who picked you up and drove you all the way in from Heathrow and didn't stop talking, you know. Instead, they lived a life like they were medieval princes, you know, in these crazy outfits and shoes with buckles. And they all start taking LSD and everything gets completely surreal and strange. And Brian Jones actually moves to the house owned by A.A. Milne, where he set Winnie the Pooh and said he was very much like Winnie the Pooh and doing what Winnie the Pooh did. Mm-hmm. You know, so there was this borderline fantasy thing, and that's what was so shocking to them, I think, about the end of the 60s, which is after Altamont, the realization that this movement wasn't leading to Narnia, it was leading to the 70s.
Yeah.
You know, to this big giant hangover of the 70s, which is where I grew up. I mean, if you ask me where I'm from, I guess technically it's from Chicago, but really it's from 1977 or something.
Yeah. But, of course, there is the music. And, you know, Brian Jones, for all of his many demons, you know, was a very musical person. I love the way you describe his guitar playing on the song No Expectations. I think you say he vanished into his own playing.
Right. Well, I always thought of the sort of Buddhist idea, which is like a flame so pure it consumes all its own fuel. And that's what I feel like he did. And for him, this connection to Chicago, which is, he met a friend who was totally into blues, Alexis Korner, this famous guy, and he just...
Well, famous in blues circles.
Right, famous in blues circles, and he had this incredible record collection with records nobody had. And he went through them. Brian Jones stayed at his apartment, and he came across Elmore James' Dust My Broom. We'll be right back. Brian Jones said hearing that was the most important discovery of his life. And he learned how to play slide guitar. And he started playing in this little club in London, and it opened only for a couple weeks. And Keith and Brian Jones and another guy named Dick Taylor, who's an early member of the Stones, walk in and they see Brian Jones playing slide guitar. And that became the defining thing. That moment sort of creates the Rolling Stones. And Brian Jones sort of burns out for a whole bunch of reasons. One is, it's his band. He named it. He put the ad in the newspaper. He had the idea. He would be the guy that would talk between songs. And he lost control of the band. He lost control partly just because when they moved, like you said, when they moved out of the little clubs into the places with the Screaming Girls focused on the singer.
Right.
And that's where the power went. And then when Jagger and Richard started to write the songs, that's where the power went again. So he was kind of, and then he took LSD early and he had problems. But on the song No Expectations, it's sort of the last time where Brian Jones is completely coherent in his playing. And you hear him playing that slide guitar at the very, very end. And it's an echo of the very, very beginning. And there's a purity to it that just kind of takes your breath away.
You know, context is everything, and a big part of your book is putting the Rolling Stones in context. The thing that made the Stones wasn't five guys, two of them are guitar artists and two of them are fighting and one of them's addicted to something.
Right.
What made them the Stones was that everything else around them was not the Stones. It was like the anti-Stones. I mean, you write in the book, this. What made Elvis Presley Elvis Presley was Perry Como.
Right. Well, that's what's missing.
That's, yeah.
The key thing that's missing is go look at, you know, when the Rolling Stones appear on the famously on the Tammy show where James Brown is famously appears and sort of mm-hmm. teaches Mick Jagger supposedly how to dance and
right,
everything.
Right, right.
Go watch that and watch Jan and Dean and yeah. the Beach Boys and Leslie Gore. And all the other acts that were big then. And then out of that comes Mick Jagger, who's so sexual and so dirty. And the music, which is so dirty. And they're playing it, you know, on television in 19, whatever it was, 65.
Yeah, I think
and
so.
Patti Smith, I quote her in the book, she wrote about that moment of seeing them, I think, on that show being that's when she basically left her father, you know?
and a song, you know, you specifically point out a song like Satisfaction. That, you know, this thrice familiar song, we all know that riff. You tell the story
right.
of, you know, Keith waking up and finding that he had recorded the riff in the middle of the night. But again, placing it in its context is what makes that song so remarkable.
Right. Well, first of all, Satisfaction, like I guess it's 66. Think about a guy who's 50 years old, what year he would have been born, you know. So what, 1916?
16.
Think, and he would have, you know, been a kid through the Depression and through World War II and all that. And now here comes this song, which is really a suggestive, dirty song with this, you know, very Chuck Berry-like kind of riff all dirtied up, played with this fuzz guitar. And you would see that it would jump out of the radio as something entirely and completely different. And that's what you miss. That's what you try to recapture when you write a book, which is what does this sound like now? And we've all seen Apocalypse Now, you know, and seen the song all over the place. What did it sound like if you first heard it on a radio in Minneapolis in 1966?
I tried.
But now here's the thing about the Rolling Stones, Rich. Yes, Satisfaction comes on the radio, and that guy who was born 50 years earlier, it sounds like it might as well come from Mars.
You know,
it's so alien. But now, 50 years on, the Stones are still here. They're still playing Satisfaction. So
that's a shocking, that's an amazing thing. I think about that all the time, which is in 1963, the Stones got together. Were there guys listening to music from, you know, 1913 in 1963? It's hard to imagine that they were.
Yeah.
I mean, so there's something about, we got onto this page, and one thing I do remember Jagger telling me early on, and I didn't even put this in the book, is that for the first part of rock and roll, a lot of the songs were about rock and roll itself.
Mm-hmm.
Rock and roll will never die, because everybody believed it would die, and it would be just another craze like the Twist or something. And the idea that you could do this forever, you know, was an ridiculous idea. And Mick Jagger famously said, I'd rather be dead than playing Satisfaction at 45. And here he is. He's 70 whatever, and he's playing Satisfaction. But it was just an inconceivable reality that the culture that the baby boomers sort of created would become the mass culture.
Essentially, these guys cheated fate.
Right.
They're like creatures out of legend. They're dinosaurs, but they still roam the earth.
Right.
How did this happen?
And I almost feel like they're an endangered species. There's just a few of them left, and they almost kind of all have the same face, which is that old, grizzled, rock star face. And there's a famous thing where somebody first met Jagger and said, oh, I can't believe you had so many lines in your face. And he said, they're laugh lines. And the guy said, well, you know what? Nothing's ever been that funny. But it is. I mean, it is that funny. The lives they've lived have to be some of the most surreal, unusual lives of the 20th century.
Will we ever see their like again?
I don't know. I don't think so. What happened is, I think the LP record kind of died, and that a lot of the energy, you know, people like, what's the energy that drove this music that was so important? It's like when people would wait for the new iPhone. I mean, it sounds ridiculous to compare it to, but that kind of youthful energy of what's going to come next, what's going to change it, where is it going, how's this one record going to change my life and give me a new direction to my life, that was an avant-garde that they were at the front of, and it's kind of moved on.
All right, so then a final question, and it's a callback to something you alluded to before, the last great Stones record, a more complicated question than it sounds.
It's Some Girls, which is truly one of the great Stones records. And what's interesting is, even by Some Girls, there were problems. Keith had been busted in Toronto for heroin. And basically, I think the Sex Pistols came out and said, the Rolling Stones are finished. Your old men get off the stage. They probably were 35.
Yeah.
And that kind of pissed off Keith Richards. And I always thought it was like the gunslinger puts the guns on for, you know, Gary Cooper one more time, one more trip into town to prove he's still got it. And they got together, and at the time, they were kind of fighting over, you know, Jagger was in New York. And it's really a New York album, and you hang out like in club, you know, Studio 54, and have all these disco licks. Mm-hmm. And Keith was the blues. And that fight between the blues and disco, it's sort of like the dialectic of rock and roll history. And you hear the fight on that album. And it's this incredible combination of the blues and disco that yields this incredibly great record, and songs like Beast of Burden and Miss You that are all about the battle between musical styles. And it's the last time they really got it together and made a masterpiece.
Well, that's where we'll leave it, with a little bit of that album, Some Girls, by the Rolling Stones. The book is called The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones. Rich Cohen is the author. He also is the co-creator of HBO's TV series Vinyl. He's been with us here on Soundcheck. Rich, great to have you with us.
Thanks so much. Really fun.
This is Soundcheck.